Anyway, welcome. Delighted to see you at this seminar today, which is on a most interesting subject. This is really a joint effort between Global Strategy Forum, of which I'm the chairman and chairing today's seminar, and CSOX at Oxford. I think you've all had the papers relating to this, including the biographies and a note on the background. But just briefly to say, the background to it was that after the first agreement of principles, which was signed by Serbia and Kosovo in April last year, under the auspices of the EU, a workshop on this subject was organised by the Southeast European Studies at Oxford in association with the Department of Politics and International Relations at the University of London and LSE. That was effectively a closed session, but it was felt that the outcome of it was so interesting that we should give it a wider audience, and the four speakers we have today are going to effectively report back on that, and then obviously I will open it to questions afterwards. Now, I don't want to take up too much time, but except to say that I'm delighted to see the progress that has been made in this particular area. As some of you know, I've been a long adherent of the principle that dialogue is better than war in solving international problems, and I think here we have had an instance of hard work and hard dialogue which is beginning to produce results. So I'm delighted to welcome our speakers and all of you here today. I'm going to go straight on now into the actual programme itself with the presentations, and the first of these is going to be given by Professor Richard Kaplan, who's sitting on my right. He's the Professor of International Relations at the University of Oxford, and if you need any more information, it is there in the biography which has been provided to you. Richard Kaplan.
Thank you. I'm live.
Yeah, you'll go live.
All right. thank you very much, and welcome to today's seminar. Just to put things into context, we had in December, as you will have seen in the papers, a day-long event, day-long workshop, to which we invited representatives from the region, many of whom had taken part directly in the discussions, negotiations leading to the first agreement between Serbia and Kosovo of April 19, 2013. And what each of us will be doing on the panel this morning is to provide highlights of each of the four sessions. The first session was devoted to a discussion of getting the parties to the negotiating table. But before I talk about that session, I just wanted to highlight that the agreements, the April 19 agreement and the subsequent agreements, are really an extraordinary achievement, not a panacea by any means, but a very important step forward in normalizing relations between Belgrade and Pristina. And if any of you have an opportunity to see, there is a video of a session from the Munich Security Conference that was held last week, this past weekend, that session was convened by Baroness Ashton with the prime ministers of Kosovo, Thaci, and Serbia, Dacic. And it was quite extraordinary to see them on a common forum when in dialogue with one another. And when one thinks about how difficult that relationship has been, it really is an extraordinary achievement, these agreements and the ongoing dialogue. There have been 21 meetings between the parties, 220 hours of dialogue, and 10 working groups formed since the April 19 agreement was signed last May, covering everything from car insurance to police integration. So really, as I said, quite extraordinary. And the first panel of our day-long workshop looked at how, as I said, it was possible to get the parties to the negotiating table after years of generally fruitless attempts on the part of the international community to engage the parties meaningfully. Now, was it fortuitous circumstances? Was it skillful diplomacy, or a combination of the two? Fortuitous circumstances were certainly a critical factor. And there is a lesson here for other difficult negotiating situations, which we may want to discuss afterwards. But the moment was clearly ripe for a possible breakthrough. So what had changed to make the difference? Well, on the Serbian side, there were two important developments. One was the International Court of Justice's advisory opinion of July 2010. Belgrade had sought support for its opposition to Kosovo's unilateral declaration of independence from the International Court of Justice, to which the UN General Assembly had referred the matter. But while the ICJ advisory opinion wasn't a resounding victory for Kosovo, it took no position on whether Kosovo was a state, for instance, it certainly represented a defeat for Serbia insofar as it failed to support Serbia's contention that Kosovo's declaration of independence was contrary to international law. Now, the other important development, I'd say, that transformed the situation was Serbia's desire for EU candidate status, for which Serbia had applied in 2009. In March 2012, the European Council confirmed Serbia as a candidate country, and in June the following year endorsed the Commission's recommendation to open negotiation with Serbia. So, as both the Serbian leadership and the Serbian public have turned their attention increasingly to the future and to Serbia's place in the EU, they've become more open to normalization of relations with Kosovo, knowing that this is a formal requirement for accession to the European Union. Now, on the Kosovo side, there was a reluctance to engage in negotiations that Pristina feared threatened to reopen the status question. This was their biggest concern. But here, too, the situation now was more propitious for negotiations. For one thing, the ICJ advisory opinion didn't give unqualified support to Kosovo. In fact, it sidestepped the question of Kosovo's statehood for the most part. And moreover, it didn't unleash a wave of recognitions as Pristina had hoped and expected. Now, there had been more recognitions, totaling 86 UN member states by the start of 2012. It now stands at 107. But for the most part, these were minor states. And also, Kosovo faced a range of serious problems that only improved relations with Belgrade could alleviate. It didn't have complete control of the territory in the north, which was calling into question Kosovo's factual sovereignty and the legitimacy of its governing structures. Now, there was also some discussion at the workshop about whether and to what extent divisions within the EU hindered or helped to bring the parties to the table. Five member states had not and still have not recognized Kosovo's independence, which has prevented the EU from adopting common positions with regard to Kosovo. And this has complicated decision-making within the EU, and it's hard to see, therefore, how this could at all be helpful to the situation. But in fact, and this was very interesting to hear from the participants, it has been helpful in some ways. With regard to Serbia, for instance, it allowed President Boris Tadic to portray the EU as status neutral. And this made it easier for him to accept a role for the EU as a mediator, and also allowed him to generate support for the goal of EU accession, which in turn has only increased EU leverage. So a rather perverse, if you will, but very favorable outcome to what would appear to be a position of weakness for the EU. And that was, as I said, very interesting to hear. So a combination of factors can account for the parties' willingness to come to the negotiating table. First, the Serbia-Kosovo conflict was ripe for mediation for very different reasons. Both Serbia and Kosovo were now more willing to engage in negotiations. Continued stalemate was not seen to be of benefit to either. Secondly, the EU, although divided on the matter, indeed precisely because it was divided on the matter, was seen to be an honest broker to the parties. And third, and finally, but certainly not leastly, the diplomacy conducted by Baroness Ashton's office made it possible to take full advantage of the ripeness of that moment. So, as I said, this was, these are some of the highlights of what was a very interesting, illuminating, and wide-ranging discussion about getting the parties to the negotiating table, the first session of four of that day's workshop.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Professor Kaplan. That was a very interesting introduction to what was obviously a very interesting session you had in November. The next presentation will be made by Sir David Madden, former ambassador and is chair of the CSOX Development Committee. I've experienced in this type of negotiations in the past.
Thank you very much, Chairman. Well, Richard has brought us to the negotiating table, and it's my task to bring us to yes. And I would like to draw out four points from the discussion during the second session of the workshop. First, the technical talks. These began in early 2011 under the auspices of the European Union, and the vital background was set out by Richard that the ICJ had failed to support Serbia's contention that Kosovo UDI was contrary to international law, but equally took no stand on whether Kosovo was a state. There was therefore room for negotiation and for a facilitator. And the overall objective was to bring the two sides together and resolve practical problems. Low-hanging fruit, if you like, though it was not always so low-hanging or easy to dislodge. The idea at that stage was to build trust and thus open the way for political issues to be tackled. An example of such a technical problem were the civil registry books from Kosovo. The Serbs had them, the Kosovars needed them in order to function. This immediately raised the question of the legality of the Kosovo state. And the answer? The humble photocopier. Copies of the registry books were handed to Pristina. And a number of similar issues, for example, freedom of movement of individuals and vehicles, were similarly resolved. The establishment of integrated boundary or border management was a major step forward. But the issue of Kosovo customs stamps was more challenging. The inability to resolve this successfully led to violence in northern Kosovo in July and August 2011. It was finally resolved with agreement that the stamps would refer not to the Republic of Kosovo, but just to Kosovo. By this stage, it was clear that behind every apparently technical issue lurked a political difficulty, and therefore that the dialogue had to be raised to the political level. Secondly, therefore, the political dialogue. This began after the election of a new government in Belgrade with the Serbian Progressive Party, the strongest party. It was clear that neither the Serbs nor the Kosovars were negotiating from a position of great strength. Belgrade was aware that Serbia's position on Kosovo was becoming weaker and that their overriding priority was to improve their credibility with the EU. They did not want to see the Serbs in Kosovo cut off, nor have a permanently hostile neighbour. Kosovo was perhaps reluctant to re-engage in political negotiations with Belgrade, but understood that the only way to integrate the North was through dialogue. There was also a desire to follow the advice of their friends in the West and open up their own accession path to the EU. Out of this rather uneasy mixture of factors, the two sides, with the extensive help and encouragement of the EU, managed to fashion the first agreement of principles covering the normalisation of relations, which, as Richard mentioned, was signed in April 2013. Thirdly, the idea of setting up the Association of Serb Municipalities in North Kosovo was fundamental to progress. This arose from the tension between Pristina's desire to dismantle Serb institutions and the wish of Belgrade and the Serbs in North Kosovo to preserve them. The compromise solution was to repackage them in their existing form, but in Kosovo's administrative system. The broad sphere of competence of the association was agreed, but many of the details were left to be thrashed out later. Both sides appeared to accept and even embrace the concept of constructive ambiguity. As with the creation of KFOR, questions of status were for later. The first agreement is commendably brief, less than 1.5 A4 pages. There you are, an example of negotiation skill. 15 brief paragraphs, 6 on the role and competences of the association, 3 on the police, 1 Kosovo police force, but a Kosovo Serb regional commander of the 4 northern Serb majority municipalities, 2 paragraphs on the judiciary with similar provisions, and separate paragraphs on municipal elections, on energy and telecoms, and on an implementation committee. And hiding away at paragraph 14 is an all-important sentence. It is agreed that neither side will block or encourage others to block the other side's progress in their respective EU path. Fourth, this is all very much work in progress. First, continuing implementation of the technical agreements. Secondly, implementation of the first agreement. And thirdly, work on a second agreement to define both the representation of Serbs in Kosovo's central institutions, remembering that the majority of Serbs in Kosovo live south of the river Ibar, and also the protection of cultural and religious heritage. Talks, as Richard said, are therefore continuing. So, to conclude and summarise my part, the first agreement fully demonstrated the role of EU as magnet and mentor. Good practical work was achieved, but there is a long way to go.
Shorter the piece of paper that produced, the more likely it is to succeed. So I'd like to see that was part of it. Next presentation is by Dr. James Lindsay, the Eurobank Senior Research Fellow on the Politics of Southeast Europe at the European Institute.
Thank you very much. So I'll cover what amounted to the third and the fourth sessions that we had on the day, which dealt with questions of implementation and where we can expect the dialogue between Serbia and Kosovo to go in the future. I think really sort of leading on from the point that David had made, I mean, there are a number of areas that have still got to be tackled. The Brussels Agreement was tremendously important. It presents, if you like, an overarching political framework for the two sides to be able to talk with each other in the future, that a lot of key issues have been dealt with in that. So, for example, laying the foundations for some sort of formalised agreement for the Serbs in the north, something I'll talk about again in a minute. But there are a large number of other areas where there have got to be functional working agreements reached between Belgrade and Pristina, and that will be the focus of the talks as they go ahead. I think in terms of the situation on the ground at the moment, we are now in a rather interesting phase. There were groundbreaking municipal elections that were held in Kosovo in November last year. Rather interestingly, the Serbs in the south actually had a very high turnout rate, and that sort of rather mirrored the elections, the previous municipal elections, which rather indicates that they are now comfortable with the existence of an independent state of Kosovo. That's not to say that they necessarily like it, but they accept it. And in actual fact, the turnout rates in the Serbian areas south of the Ibar were actually higher than in the Albanian parts of the country, the majority Albanian parts of the country. But this was always really about the situation in the north, and that's where the focus was. The election results there were perhaps less impressive. The turnout rates were around 20%, and even then, I think it's fair to say, there were a lot of very significant irregularities, which actually, interestingly enough, it was in no one's interest to highlight. It wasn't in the interest of the government in Pristina, it wasn't in the interest of the government in Belgrade, nor was it in the interest of the international community to raise it. But it is worth noting that there were a lot of very serious issues that were raised on the ground there about the way that the process took place. And it was almost as though this was an example of Belgrade, the international community and Pristina wanting to just get these elections out of the way. The problem is that since then, the mayor of northern Mitrovica has refused to take his seat. which means that we're now going to see another round of elections have to take place later this month. They have been further complicated by the fact that what I think most people, the person that most people would feel is the leading candidate, Oliver Ivanovich, has now been arrested and is in jail on suspected war crimes. Very, very interesting development for anyone who follows Kosovo, because he was always seen as a very moderate figure and a figure that could work very closely with Pristina. This has certainly raised a lot of questions, and I think that this is one of the things that we need to look to. Not least of all, because it is absolutely vital that the Serbian Municipalities Association, which has been set up, which was agreed as part of the Brussels Agreement in April last year, is put into action. This will become the most significant voice, if you like, for the Serbs, especially those living in the north of Kosovo, in the institutions of Kosovo. And so I think it's generally regarded as being vital to ensuring further Serbian participation in Kosovo. On that note, I think it's also very important to point out that there have been a lot of discussions about the significance of the association, what it stands for, what it means, and where it will go. In Pristina, for a number of reasons, there is a great deal of concern about any moves to grant Serbs greater autonomy than they have. One thing that you hear time and time again is, we don't want another Republika Srpska. And that is a very, very profound worry that you hear from the Albanians in Kosovo. I mean, the reality is that nobody for one minute is proposing another Republika Srpska model. I think anyone who's had any dealings with Bosnia, and I know that David had a lot of experience, would readily accept that this is really not a model that we should be looking at. But that means that there are any number of other models in Europe that we can look at. For example, South Tyrol, which should be given a better hearing and which aren't. As I say, I think one of the problems that we're dealing with at the moment in terms of implementation is this fixation that we're creating some sort of conditions for Serbs in the north to break away. It's very clear now that Belgrade has essentially given up on the partition agenda. This was very strong. It never asked for it. And I think it's fair to say it's now lost that opportunity. Another aspect that I think is important to stress in all of this is that there tends to be this belief, and this happens not just in the case of Kosovo, but in any number of other conflicts, that once you sign the peace deal, that's it. But of course, it's never as simple as that. I mean, as we've seen here in Britain from the example of Northern Ireland, you sign that big overarching political agreement, and then there are any number of micro negotiating processes which have got to take place in terms of implementation. And I think that's what we're going to be seeing in Kosovo, and we've got to be aware of that. There are going to be problems. This is a very significant agreement. There's a lot that needs to be done. New areas have got to be opened. And also, we are going to see problems along the way in terms of implementation. But I think it's fair to say that it's so far, so good. One of the things that we picked up very strongly at the event was a sense of frustration amongst the Kosovo participants about their EU accession path. There was a real sense that because of the five non-recognised, that Kosovo's moves towards the European Union were being held up. We did, a number of us, try and stress, and I remember that this was a point that a few people made, that this shouldn't be allowed to become sort of received wisdom in Pristina and amongst Kosovo Albanians. The fact that five countries don't recognise Kosovo is not nearly as problematic as is often presented. The countries have all accepted that Kosovo has a European future, even if they don't recognise it as an independent state. And it's very, very telling that of the five countries that don't recognise, only one now, I think, is considered to be a major obstacle, and that's Spain. It seems rather likely that we could see two, maybe three recognitions within the next 2 years. I think the main candidates would be Greece, Romania and Slovakia, and I'm willing to answer questions to why that might be the case. But Kosovo has also got to become aware that the support that they had in the process leading to independence doesn't necessarily translate to an easy ride in terms of EU accession. And I think that this is one of the things that has rather seemed to sink in. that because it does have this support, that then it means that countries like Britain, Germany, France are going to try and push it into the European Union, give it some sort of expedited process. And of course, that's not going to happen. And it was very telling that the reactions that one saw in Kosovo when in December Britain, Germany, Netherlands blocked Albania's candidacy for EU membership on the basis that it wasn't ready for it. This came as a real surprise to people. They thought that this was a given because these countries had been so strongly in favour of Kosovo's independence. And I think that this is one of the things which perhaps in Pristina they haven't really taken on board yet. The independence process was one thing. It was handled for very clear political reasons by these countries. But membership of the European Union is something very, very different, that Kosovo has got to be up to the standards required. After Bulgaria and Romania, we know the problems that arise if you take in a country before it's ready for membership. And I think that this is one of the things that's got to sink in many ways in Kosovo. They can't expect this fast-track procedure, as I think many are expecting. And also this idea, I stress again, that the five countries that don't recognise are not going to block Kosovo's further accession process. There are very real questions about whether Kosovo could ever join the European Union without being a member of the United Nations. And speaking with officials from the European Commission, they have actually said, look, we have our doubts as to whether this is the case, because a member of the EU would have to be able to act in all sorts of multilateral fora, and whether it's a member of the UN would be very important. But right up to that point, the process of accession to the European Union is very much an internal EU matter that can be dealt with by the EU as it sees fit. And I get no indication whatsoever that we are going to see major obstacles arise in that. So this then brings us, I think, to what was the big question that we were looking at during the day, which is what happens now in terms of Serbia's relationship with Kosovo. Can we expect Serbia to recognise Kosovo? Now, of course, the position that's taken by the Serbian government is it will not recognise Kosovo. The position taken by the European Union is that there's no formal requirement for Serbia to recognise Kosovo, especially as, of course, you have the five countries that don't recognise at the moment. However, looking a little bit beyond that, I mean, a more complicated picture emerges. Although it may not be an official criteria for EU membership for Serbia, the reality is that a number of countries, parliamentarians, for example, in Germany, have made it very clear, to use a particular phrase, we don't want another Cyprus. And that there is a great deal of reluctance to take in Serbia unless it's reached a final conclusive agreement with Pristina, which is based on recognition. And I think that, you know, this is something that is understood in Belgrade, that essentially at the end, when Serbia is ready for membership, it's going to have to be under a condition that there is some sort of real recognition of the existence of Kosovo as a state. Now, how that is going to happen is obviously something that's open to speculation. We are actually in a very interesting period now in Serbia, where there's going to be new elections next month. It seems highly likely that the government, as it's currently structured, will change. And I think looking ahead, this is the key thing now, that how will this new government be able to manage its relations with Pristina? There's been a very good working relationship that's existed between the two prime ministers. Richard raised that point at the Munich Security Conference. It was incredible to see them on stage together talking with Baroness Ashton. Nobody would have felt that this would have been possible 2 years ago, to have a prime minister of Serbia and Kosovo on that stage. But we are going to see, I think it's fairly clear to say, a change in the constellation of the government in Serbia in the next 6 weeks to 2 months. And where this goes from there, I think really now is the key question. Thank you.
Thank you very much, James. Now, the final presentation, I'm going to ask Othon Anastasakis, who's the director of CSOX and the director of the European Studies Centre at Stanford Music College, Oxford. Dr. Anastasakis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for having us here. My brief presentation will be about the regional implications and what the Serbia-Kosovo path towards normalization means for the region. And these are also issues that we are discussing a lot at CSOX. there's no doubt that this is a major achievement for the European Union, and Baroness Ashton should be very, very happy to have in her background, as it were, this this victory. And especially at a time when the European Union is going through a difficult moment, because we shouldn't forget that, both as an actor, as an external actor in international affairs, as well as in its own internal affairs. So this is the positive message that we get out of this agreement. Of course, the devil is in the detail. As James said, a lot is to be seen in the process of implementation. There's always been this kind of comparison with other cases in the region as well. And whether, as James said, there is Republika Srpska. Now, that is an issue and a fear, not just at the level of governance and whether the association of the Serb municipalities are going to create an extra layer of power that could not be controlled by the center, as it happens in the case of Bosnia, where we are seeing more and more a dysfunctional state. But it's also at the level of reconciliation, which is very important, and also at the level of identities, language spoken, and in general, how, you know, the fear that these two communities may be alienated, which is actually what we have seen in Cyprus a lot between Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots. And how that also affects the relations between Republika Srpska and Serbia as well. Because Dodik, for instance, used to have good relations with Tadic, but that's not necessarily the case at the moment with the current government in Serbia. So that's one point in terms of parallels with other parts of the region. My second point that I would like to say is, and extend a little bit beyond the discussion that we've been hearing, is that we are seeing actually, because of this normalization, start of normalization process, a desecuritization of the of the debate, and taking the approach towards Kosovo, but also the regional approach in matters that are more about governance, about economy, and about the European accession of these countries. Now, there are some issues which are very common in the region, as we all know, not just the candidate countries and the aspirant EU members, but also among member states, that have to do with the rule of law, judicial reform, organized crime and corruption. But there are also significant problems within Kosovo itself in terms of these areas. Then there's the issue of the economy, which is particularly important because Kosovo is the most underdeveloped place in Europe. For next year, there is growth projected at the 4% level, but that is also because Kosovo starts from a very low point. Now, on the other side, Serbia is also facing grave economic difficulties with very high unemployment, which is 23%, a high deficit, which is at 8%, and a big number of non-performing loans. More and more, the economy within the Serbian public feeling is getting a priority, even over Kosovo, according to later surveys. One thing about these elections is also is that the aim, as we know, is to strengthen Vucic's position within Serbian politics, and then having to pursue a very rigorous reform process that will entail austerity measures, that would also have a reform in the pension system, in labor reforms, diminishing the state budget excesses, and so on and so forth. But the main optimistic and a good thing that we take out of this is that Serbia, from a pariah state that it used to be not so long ago, now it is becoming a partner of the European Union. And my third and final point, which actually comes from the Serbia, Kosovo, or Belgrade, Pristina relationship is the issue of non-recognition in the Balkans. And that we see it in many ways. We see it as a non-recognition of a new state, not just by Serbia, but also by five other EU member states. There's a non-recognition of borders, of property rights, of minority rights, of languages, of Orthodox churches. There are abuses of history. And that also in the context of identity politics and rulers that want to remain in power and actually overusing this. So that issue of non-identity, of non-recognition, of is something that, you know, at times it can be solved, like we've seen in the cases of Slovenia and Croatia, where there was a border dispute, and it did manage through the international court and international mediation to be solved. There's also the accession, which we are now seeing in the case of Serbia and Kosovo, but at times these are also issues that the European Union or international mediation cannot do much to help. Having said that, it is indeed Kosovo, just to finish with a very general statement, that, you know, that when there is the political will that we have seen, when there is external pressure that we've also seen, and a carrot, usually you can have this. And, you know, what we've seen in Serbia, Kosovo, was also the Nixon moment in China. I mean, you know, a former nationalist kind of government, with a nationalist side in Kosovo as well, coming together in the negotiating table, something that the more moderate previous government wasn't able to do.
Thank you very much indeed. I think you'll agree we've had a fascinating series of presentations, and I'm very grateful to our speakers for having launched our seminar so effectively. I'm now going to open it to questions and comments from the floor. I'm going to start by giving precedence to those around the horseshoe, but I will try and get as many people as I possibly can. Starting, can those I call please introduce themselves for the benefit of the rest of the audience? Tony?
I'm Tony Baldry. I'm a Conservative MP. I have a question really for David. I love the concept of unconstructed ambiguity. It seems to be one that office will pursue more widely, perhaps not least with our post 2015 negotiations with the community more generally. But it seems to me that Serbia wants EU membership, Kosovo wants de jure recognition. I seem to be assumed from what you and other colleagues were saying that you thought that de jure recognition would in due course come about if eventually Kosovo itself got EU membership. But what is to prevent a choreography of Serbia getting its EU membership at the same time as Kosovo getting de jure recognition?
Thank you for a very interesting question. Of course, Kosovo wants two things. Kosovo wants both international recognition and also, in due course, EU membership. So Kosovo's got two things in play. Serbia has one thing in play. And that, I think, is another reason for the feeling which James reported, which was that the Kosovars at our workshop seem to be more unhappy about things than their Serbian counterparts, and one can quite understand that. I mean, in the end, I think that James has helped us towards solving this problem. And the other thing that helps us solve this problem is time. I mean, in the case of Serbia, and no doubt the Serbian ambassador will correct me here, but I think we're probably looking at about 8 years would be a conservative estimate for how long it will take Serbia to enter the European Union. So we've got time. And obviously Kosovo is effectively, because it's a stage behind, that will be an even longer process. Now, I think, as James has suggested, that some of the problems connected with recognition are probably superable in that sort of time frame. and that the important thing to remember about the EU5 is that they're not an EU5. They're five separate countries which, for separate reasons, have decided against recognition now. And I think the number will diminish. And as James quite rightly said, in my view, I think Spain, for fairly as obvious reasons, is the biggest problem. But, you know, if one projects ahead 10 years, perhaps the problem will look different in that time. So I wouldn't want to see, I wouldn't want to see the EU fobbing off Kosovo with anything less than, in the end, you know, full membership of the European Union.
And us?
Yes, thank you very much. You know, James...
Can you introduce yourself?
Yes, yes. Ordin Pavicic, Ambassador of Serbia. Thank you very much. Actually, James posted a very interesting question. What will happen after the elections in Serbia, having in mind that we in Serbia are going to have elections on the 16th of March? And my view is that it is pretty clear that business will continue as usual, in terms that no matter who will be in the government, but at the moment it's obvious that the Serbian Progressive Party will have Prime Minister, and having in mind that Mr. Vucic showed himself as a completely devoted to this process, so we have all good reasons to do believe that the process will continue. And a few very brief comments on the issue, which I completely agree with my predecessors, about why process is now going up and commented as an extraordinary achievement. First of all, I have to underline again the role of EU, which is really substantial and tremendous. And we are very grateful to Lady Ashton and to EU. But another thing which I would like very much to stress is, and this is probably the crucial, that both sides, Kosovo and Serbian side, came to the conclusion that this process is vital for both sides, for all different reasons. And I think this is the crucial, you know, that in Pristina and Belgrade they understood finally that not only because of big issues, you know, like borders, customs, but because of life of ordinary people, and not only on the north of Kosovo, but in all the region, it's vital to have good relations and normalization of relations between Pristina and Belgrade. And living there in Serbia, you know, and I came here in October, I can tell you, last year, I can tell you that the climate is so in Belgrade. So all important players, all important media, all important NGOs are on this track, and they are pushing towards the so-called process of normalization, except one or two political parties, which is not so minor, I must stress, as people can understand that they get 6 or 5%. They have much more supporters, but the mainstream of political and intellectual life is for the positive things and for the Brussels Agreement. And I will conclude with this. What is the most important in the future? I think the very, very important, I completely agree, is that we have the elections on the north of Kosovo, and it clearly shows the political will on both Belgrade, EU, and Pristina. And of course it is difficult with the people who are living on the north, but finally, we got three mayors, we will get another one in February, and the future political process will be the key. So we will have elections on Kosovo, parliamentarian elections, and as you probably have seen, Munich conference, my Prime Minister, Mr. Ivica Dačić, said that he will encourage Serbs to take place in these elections, of course, under some certain circumstances. This is quite normal. But we have plenty of time to discuss this in the next 6 months. And I think that somehow we will come to the conclusion, because, as I said, it is really, I think, that more and more people understood that it is in the interest of both sides. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ambassador, for that very useful insight.
Sorry, yes, I just wanted to raise, I think it's important to stress that on this point, I completely agree. I don't see any possibility of any future Serbian government, certainly from the vantage point we are now, rescinding any of the deals that have been reached, trying to turn back to the previous policy. That's not going to happen. But I think we also need to recognise that after the elections, it seems certain that there will be a new Prime Minister. And I think it's going to be a rather difficult and interesting situation to observe, in as much as, you know, so much of this process has been built up around the characters of the two Prime Ministers as they are. It's Dacic and Thatcher, and it's about the rapport that they've managed to build up. And reports that have come out from the meetings have suggested that, you know, there have been times when Deputy Prime Minister Vucic, who will be Prime Minister Vucic, you know, tempers have raised a bit. And, you know, that's going to raise very serious questions. Will he be able to have that personal sense of rapport with Prime Minister Thatcher? And will the new government coming in and the people who will also be sat at those meetings in Brussels have that sort of willingness to engage? And I think that that's one key factor to keep an eye on. The other one, of course, is the fact that there are a lot of very difficult decisions that are going to have to be made and sold to public opinion in Serbia. I think the public opinion in Serbia is a lot more ready these days to accept things. But, you know, we are talking about questions of recognition and greater participation in international organisations. And again, it's been very easy for Prime Minister Vucic, Deputy Prime Minister Vucic, for him to be able to say, well, look, you know, I have confidence in the Prime Minister. They don't obviously get on very well, but it's very convenient for him to have a Prime Minister who can make these difficult decisions. In 6 weeks' time, he is going to be in the driving seat. He will not be able to blame it on anyone else. He's going to have to be the one to take responsibility for all of this. And the question I have is, I wonder if, when he is confronted with that situation, whether he'll be able to do it, or whether he'll shy away from making decisions which Dacic has been able to make. Yeah.
Thank you. Tim Boswell, I chair the Lords EU Select Committee, which reported last year on future enlargement. I'd like to concentrate, or ask the panel to concentrate the discussion for a moment on the economic situation. Because, as has been said, this is probably the least successful part of the European continent in terms of its economic development, although it has great potential. We did not emphasise that perhaps as much as we might now. Although most of the themes which we did produce have been very much taken up and amplified and encouraged today. The area that I particularly feel we might have done more on with reflection, but it's a slightly uncovered book except for those who are experts in it, is the instrument for pre-accession assistance and the other facilities which are available to EU members in terms of regional assistance anyway, and how these might be joined together. Naturally, this comes together in terms of infrastructure. And I have the impression that up till now, there have been, as it were, bilateral perspectives between the Commission on the one hand and the individual either member, or typically applicant member state, saying you need to sort out your justice system, here's money or training which can go towards it. There are moves which I detect in the Balkans to try and look at this in a much more strategic way, slightly in the way that Dr. Anastasiadis was talking about, clearly in terms of transport corridors, but also other facilities. And there's a new iteration that even to come out, and I'm just wondering what the panel felt about a greater emphasis or premium within the EPA funds for activities which were conducted jointly, with a view to really three stages, I think. First is economic development, simple issues like trade facilitation and making sure borders are effectively open for commerce as well as for people. Secondly, in terms of the human side of this, which the ambassador's already spoken about eloquently, in terms of enabling the severed ends of societies to be re-established. And thirdly, in terms of looking for eventual mutual recognition, trying to use this process as a means of creating institutions which will transfer to the new regime that are operated bilaterally and gain mutual confidence.
Yes, I could have a couple of thoughts on this, because I certainly agree with you that your recommendations on the right path, and at the same time there is some kind of knowledge from the part of the European Union in terms of in the past having devised schemes of cross-border cooperation, FAR-CBC, where the border communities could also work with each other in order to do joint projects. And what I'm not sure about is what's going to be the priorities of the new commission, because exactly we don't know what's going to come out of the new commission, and that definitely will affect enlargement and what kind of priority it will be given. I have no doubt that at a technical level that the European Commission will proceed and try to find solutions on some problems. But at the same time, I'm not exactly sure how the enlargement agenda in general, because, you know, there is, I mean, Turkey is a separate chapter, of course, but the actual countries in the Western Balkans are an unfinished business in many ways. And in that sense, it is important how they will proceed on this. The other thing is that we don't know is how the Chapter 35, which is, I think, the any other matter, and then that includes any other business, and that includes Kosovo as well, how that is going to affect the other chapters. Mm-hmm. What kind of, you know, of strength and importance and significance it will have in the whole process.
David, you want to make a quick comment?
Yes, thank you much, Chair. I agree very much with Arthur. Just to report back on the workshop, there was a very, very strong feeling in the room that the security problems were really the past, and the future problems were mainly on the economic side, both in Kosovo and it came over very strongly. But then, just to make a sort of central point about the Brussels Agreement itself, it's a plan of management of relations. It's not a roadmap, so it doesn't have, you know, here we click in pre-accession funding and here we go. It's not that at all. Otherwise, you can get it on a page and a half. So there's a certain beauty in having a page and a half, but it doesn't sort of set it all out.
David.
Can
you introduce yourself again?
Sorry, David Haney. I'm also a member of the EU Select Committee of the House of Lords. I'm slightly startled to hear that someone in Brussels was suggesting that Kosovo might not be capable of becoming a member of the European Union because it's not a member of the United Nations. It might as well remember that the Federal Republic of Germany was also a member of the European Union for quite a long time before it was a member of the United Nations. So I don't know where they dredged up that piece of thought from, some murky depths, perhaps. What I really want to ask the panel was this. Nobody has yet addressed the question of the synchronization of the accession of Serbia and Kosovo, which is an absolutely crucial point, which was covered, of course, in the report that we wrote last year. And I don't think one should beat about the bush. If Serbia joined one day before the day Kosovo was going to join, it's quite possible Kosovo would never join. That is the reality of how the European Union takes decisions, by unanimity on every single decision from top to bottom on accession matters. We've seen it in the case. So if we say we don't want, quote, another Cyprus, then we better not have Serbia joining before Kosovo, or, for that matter, Kosovo joining before Serbia. Synchronization is the only policy that will ensure that there isn't, quote, another Cyprus.
Who would like to? Yes.
this is indeed a problem because of the.
The House of Commons beginning their business.
And this is not just with Serbia and Kosovo. This is also about the remaining countries which are outside of the EU waiting to become members. And there's always this risk, and we've seen it actually, of countries in blocking the countries out. And that has to be addressed in some way. But there is also another reality in that Serbia is much more advanced in terms of preparedness. And shouldn't forget as well that, you know, Belgrade used to be the center of Yugoslavia. So there is a know-how on how to deal with negotiations, on all those technical matters, how to deal with the European Union. Whereas Kosovo is far behind on this. And in that sense, because accession also has to happen on technical merits and whether a country is prepared or not, I mean, already there is talk in many reports that I'm reading that Serbia has become like Montenegro, a front-runner, and Kosovo with Bosnia actually are the laggards. So there's already a differentiation between this small group of countries in the Western Balkans. But the most important point is that there is also how prepared the country is to become a member. And Belgrade is much more prepared in many ways.
But then in that case, we should get about another Cyprus.
Can I ask Richard to
comment? No, I was only going to stress the point that often made, that it's envisioned that perhaps between 8 and 10 years Serbia could be eligible, meaning meet the technical criteria for accession. It would be very, very difficult, I think, to postpone the process, allowing time, and I don't know in anyone's estimate how much time, for Kosovo to catch up. It would certainly seem to be grossly unfair that one country would be hostage to developments in the other country where it might not have responsibility for those developments. It's one thing to require normalization of relations, however that might be interpreted, where Belgrade can exert a lot of influence, and they are one of the two principal actors, but another thing to insist on developments over which it doesn't really have control. I don't know if the committee considered the influence that the EU would have with respect to Serbia, and whether it was thought that it would be very difficult with sufficient pressure for Belgrade to resist. I mean, if it were, you didn't consider, or you think that...
Well, we just looked at the example of Greece and Macedonia. We didn't need to go any further.
Yeah. Another optimistic note, I guess. We'll move on to the next question. Patricia Rowling.
Patricia Rowling, I'm a backbench member of the House of Lords, and I was on the Foreign Affairs Committee in the European Parliament from 1989 to 1994. Forgive me, it's a quite ignorant question, but I just wonder, and I can't remember, what is the big difference with the negotiations that happen now with Kosovo and Serbia to do with Montenegro? What were the differences? Were there great difficulties then? Were the countries blocking then? I can't remember. I wondered if you could just remind
me. Montenegro is a country that has already started accession talks, and Serbia is starting now. The two were never connected in terms of, if that's what you mean, in terms of how they proceeded.
I think it's the separation.
The separation, you mean?
The agreement. I mean, with now that nobody's... were there all the people against Montenegro coming in? Because they've already started the accession, as you say. But weren't there not the difficulties that you have with Kosovo?
Jonathan Chaler, also from CSOX. I think the separation of the potential separation of Montenegro from Serbia, when the Federation of Montenegro and Serbia was established, and that you're correct if I'm wrong, but that was foreseen. The idea of a referendum in Montenegro was foreseen ab initio when the Federation of Serbia and Montenegro was established. So, in a sense, there wasn't... it's a little bit like the union of England and Scotland. The separation, potential separation of Scotland, has been accepted as the political choice of the people of Scotland, if that should be their wish. And the constitution of the Federation of Serbia and Montenegro foresaw a similar possibility if the wish of the people of Montenegro was to have that separation. So whereas Kosovo never had this relationship, it was always part of the Serbian Republic of the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia. Yeah.
Different case.
Yeah.
I don't want to get into a discussion on Scotland, England, devolution.
No.
I think the people of Scotland are defined as those resident in Scotland on the 14th of September next year, not necessarily Scots. So we need to leave that aside. I'm going to move on to the next question. James Gray.
I think that's.
Given the very encouraging discussion we've had so far this morning, and indeed in Brussels and in the seminar, in the previous seminar, and given that we're moving towards normalisation, as it were, and a reduction in security threats, what's the likelihood or the time frame for a NATO drawdown and or final withdrawal? And perhaps more additionally, or more controversially, what likelihood would there be that that might be replaced by an EU task force of some kind, rather, which might have a role to play given the EU's interests so far?
Which will probably be...
I don't know what the discussions within NATO at the moment are with respect to the drawdown. I mean, their presence continues to provide reassurance, but as we've been saying, and as it's widely perceived in the region, there's not perceived to be a security threat. Similarly, in Bosnia Herzegovina, even if the situation there is in some respects more unstable in some respects, but whether they would be replaced entirely, I just don't know what the discussions are with them. Maybe somebody else does in transferring those responsibilities to you, David.
Well, I wouldn't pretend to be an expert on discussions in NATO or indeed in the EU on whether this was seen as a potential task for the EU. I mean, what I would say is that this specific question, withdrawal of NATO, drawdown of NATO, wasn't really addressed in the workshop, I think for very good reason, because it was realised that NATO is still a central comfort blanket, really. And these sort of positive developments can only be seen against that background. So you'd need, I think, rather longer periods in which people were saying there's really not a big security threat before you would contemplate removing NATO. Whether it would be a good idea to for a NATO force to become an EU peacekeeping force, I think is a very moot one. I'm not sure that the experiment of an EU peacekeeping force taking over from a NATO force in Bosnia-Herzegovina would actually be considered an enormous success, though that's a totally different debate, of course. So I think NATO stays for the time being. NATO stays until the process has gone further, I would have said, but as I say, I'm privy to discussion. Because, in a way, and I think this for me was underlying a lot of the workshop, it's an open question whether the flexibility on the issue of autonomy for the Serbs in Kosovo will lead to Serbian flexibility on Kosovo sovereignty. That's still a very open question, and there's a lot of way to go on that. So my personal hope would be that NATO stay.
Osman's got a point he'd like to add to what he said to Lord Hannay's question.
Yes, because the ambassador just reminded me that in the Brussels agreement, I don't know whether you've got it, David, with you, that there is a point where it says that one side cannot block the accession of the other side. I don't know how to read this,
It's the bit I read out, but yeah. I think David was it is agreed that one side will block or encourage others to block the other side's progress in their respective EU path.
I think it's important to stress. I mean, I think that the point that Lord Hannay was making, I mean, I tend to take a more optimistic view of how Serbia will respond in a grander political framework. But as we well know, there are all sorts of small issues that can come up. And for example, there are questions now about reactions of different countries towards Serbia's EU accession. Are we going to see problems? You know, we've had indications a couple of years ago, quite from out of the blue, Romania talking about the black population in Serbia and wanting them to be given some sort of legal status. This came up, I mean, just simply days before a European Council meeting, and nobody was expecting this. I mean, you know, Serbia thought it had excellent relations with Romania because of the Kosovo issue, and suddenly, you know, Bucharest said, well, no, we've got this problem with the minority issue. There are going to be questions about, and Hungary hasn't raised any points at the moment, and I think it's widely expected, especially if we have another Orbán government, whether Hungary is going to raise questions about the Hungarian minority in Vojvodina. There is obviously questions about Serbia's relationship with Croatia. There is a question of the border, the Danube, which has got to be sorted out at some point. At the moment, the two governments are making it very clear they want to sort it out through amicable measures. But there's nothing to say that we won't get into a situation. And I think all of this is just simply to highlight, you know, we could find, I agree, that if there are smaller issues, it's not about Serbia blocking Kosovo and saying we just don't want Kosovo in the European Union, but it would be about Serbia saying, however, while we accept the principle of Kosovo in the European Union, we have this issue about the churches that we feel is unresolved. We have this issue about the minority communities and issues of local self-governance in southern Kosovo we don't feel is resolved. So, you know, I think it is important to try and balance out. So at the grand level, I don't think this is quite a worry, but we are going to have to get to a stage where all sorts of these little issues are going to have to be worked out over the next 8 years in order to make sure that the big problem of Kosovo being blocked doesn't happen.
Cyprus, the Turkish Cypriots who fled from the south have no interest in going to back to the south. Many of the Greek Cypriots who fled from the north want the right of return to the north. And my son tells me that in the southern part of Kosovo, where Serbs fled to Serbia, that when they come back, they only come back once a year to churches and cemeteries, so that they have no interest in the right to return to their homes that they abandoned. Is that the case? Do they really not have an interest in returning to what was their formerly their homeland?
Well, I think they are in the south, south of the Ebro River, the largest. Remember, we forget that because they're concentrated in the north, but in terms of absolute numbers, the largest number is south. It's a diminishing community, and I think it's fair to say that the attachment is an attachment that is exhibited largely by the older generation, and as the younger generation comes of age, and also with greater mobility, will feel perhaps less attachment. They live isolated. They do not live, for the most part, integrated with the ethnic Albanian community. This has been a long-standing situation. It's not. It's been exacerbated by violent conflict, but it's been a situation for a very long time. Unlike in other parts of former Yugoslavia, where there was greater integration, physical integration. So I don't think the question of return is a very significant one.
That's what he said, yeah.
for this community.
I think that I'd agree, but also I think this is also a reflection of the very different approaches that various countries have taken in these sorts of circumstances. So, for example, in the Cyprus case, the issue of refugees has been front and centre of political discussion. They're afforded all sorts of privileges, tax breaks, for example, and things that come with it, and a special status within Cypriot society. You don't have that in Serbia. So a large proportion of the Serbs who've gone and fled Kosovo have just simply now got on with their lives. They aren't expecting a lot from the state. And so I think you would find that although there is a general principle that they must be allowed to return, and some efforts have been made by the international community to try and persuade people, I just don't think that this is really something you're going to see. And I think the point that Richard raised, in actual fact, I mean, all the trends seem to suggest that what you're going to see is the smaller outlying enclaves of Serbs in southern Kosovo will just disappear, and that you'll eventually be left with maybe three or four key ones in the south. And then you'll have that area in the north, which will be where the main body of Serbs are aggregated at the moment. But, you know, if you're living in a tiny enclave in southern Kosovo with maybe 100 people at the moment, and you're young, I mean, why are you possibly going to want to stay in that sort of difficult position? It's something, you know, if you're very elderly, you don't know anything else, and you think, you know, why would I be a target? But, you know, if you're 16 years old and you've got your life ahead of you, I mean, they want to go to Belgrade, study there, and then, you know, Serbia will be where they forge their living.
Can I answer?
On paper, it's very important. Symbolically, it's very important that it should be there and more effort should be made. But in reality, it's not something that's been taken up. And also, there have also, I think it's important to stress, you know, where there have been examples of this taking place, you know, it has been accompanied by acts of violence in a number of cases. Not in every case, but This has raised problems as well and sent a very negative message.
We've got 10 more minutes, and I've got three people who've indicated they want to raise questions. I need to take them all together, and then I need to ask the panel if between them they can respond to them. And I think that way we'll get through in time. Madeleine Moon first.
Madeleine Moon, Labour MP, but also a member of the Labour Parliamentary Assembly. And it less of a question and more really of a reassurance to James. I'm on the Defence and Security Committee of the NATO PA. We were in March to actually visit both Kosovo and Serbia. We're actually, I just had a note this morning saying, in fact, we will be going to Kosovo because of elections. But certainly there was no indication in any of the briefing documents that we had that NATO is seeing this as an exit strategy. In fact, quite the opposite. This was very much a case of NATO looking, if you like, at a success story. And that's all I wanted to do.
Thank you very much. Gentleman in the middle.
Ma'am, my name is Euripides. I'm the High Commissioner of Cyprus. And I want to thank the panelists for the most wonderful, insightful panel. Very quickly, we are one of the five non-recognizers. But that does not mean that we are non-recognizers. We don't want to establish no establishing normal relations with Kosovo does not necessarily mean recognition. I myself, in my capacity as Deputy Permanent Secretary of the Ministry and Political Director, did visit Pristina, did visit Kosovo, and everything went very, very nicely and smoothly. It was said that the non-recognizers block the movement forward of Kosovo. Not really, I mean, I don't agree much more with what James said, to the effect that, you know, it's not en bloc, it's not coordination, everybody has their different things.
Absolutely.
You have also domestics to think about and parliament to think about. Starting from the basic premise that the Balkans must be members of the European Union to complete the peace process and to complete the experiment, from there these things come out. And we do have to have a nice tool called constructive ambiguity, and that takes us where it goes. Maybe Lord Han would say that our obsession with cessation has to do with metaphysics, maybe it has to do with metaphysics, but we're certainly, this, in terms of Kosovo, Abkhazia, South Ossetia, and when I'm asked here, and without being wanting to be seen as if I'm interfering in the foreign affairs of any country, we're also against the cessation of Scotland. We want a strong United Kingdom and a strong United Nations, and I close as to not wanting to have another Cyprus in. I can understand that fully. Nobody likes to have a divided country in the European Union. Nobody likes to represent a divided country in the European Union, but that's the situation. But believe you me, every single time Cyprus came closer to the European Union, so did Turkey. There was some horse trading, there was some give and take in Turkey, because at the end of the day, our geography is our destiny, and Turkey must become a member of the European Union.
Thank you very much. The lady in the second row.
Serious problem implementing the agreement signed by international community. But how, what sort of guarantee we have that Belgrade will implement the agreement?
I'm now going to ask the panel if they would like to sum up, starting with, on my right with David. We'll work our way around.
Thanks very much. You used a very interesting word there, prevail, which was no doubt very carefully chosen. That is a bit definitive, I think, at this stage. I think it's the immortal lines from the film The Magnificent Seven, so far so good. Actually it was one of the quite interesting themes that came out in the in our workshop was the view, particularly from on the Serbian side, of the potential for the Russians playing a role in that, in this area of the world. So, in a way, It is quite obvious, as we've said a number of times, that one of the reasons why the Serbian side signed this agreement was their overriding interest in joining the European Union. Mm. That is obviously very strong at the moment. What we should do is encourage that, because it's something we want to happen, just as we want in due course Kosovo accession. But we're in a good position. But I don't think we should declare victory too soon.
Briefly, first I just want to thank the High Commissioner for reminding us that non-recognition does not mean non-normalization of relations, does not have to mean non-normalization of relations. And I think we should all be heartened to hear that Cyprus is interested in pursuing a normalization of relations or strengthening relations with Kosovo, notwithstanding outstanding issues regarding recognition. I think to answer Denisa that the success of the EU in this region, and not just with respect to Kosovo and Serbia, is a testament to the transformative power of the EU. Whether it means that the EU has prevailed, I mean, I think there's no question the EU is the main show in town, and it's not the only show in town, and there's no reason why it should be. I hesitate to invoke the term that you use, loyalties, but I can see no reason why these countries, as is the case with many other countries, member states of the EU, shouldn't also have varying bilateral relations, ties with countries outside the EU. There's nothing mutually exclusive about a strong relationship with the EU and relations with other states. And I think that Turkey already plays an important role in the region. Russia too, and the question really is only whether the roles that they are playing or might play prospectively would be constructive roles or not. But I would hope that they would be. But there's every opportunity for them to participate.
As you're the director of China, I can ask the Serbian ambassador if you would just respond to the point that was made.
Yes, thank you so much for this question. It's a very good question about guarantees. And I think that the best proof is the results already achieved. You know, especially not only technical, but political results we achieved in the last 6 months or a year, and the fact that we had the elections on the north of Kosovo, in the, again, to underline to the interests of both sides. So I think that the best guarantee for this agreement is that obviously it is into the interests of both sides. And when the interests are coming close, I think it's very good. Sometimes, obviously, we are not happy, but we are not unhappy. And I think the same is with Kosovo people. So thank you.
Thank you very much, James.
Well, I think also not for one moment sort of doubting the goodwill of either Belgrade or Pristina to try and take this process forward. I mean, another very clear reason why Belgrade would have to implement the agreements, just as much as Pristina would have to, is the EU accession process. If either side is seen not to be playing this as they should, then you know, there's nothing to stop the EU member states just simply turning around and saying, well, look, you know, you're not living up to the terms of this. We'll halt whatever stage you are at the process. So, for example, in the case of Kosovo, it's obviously the SAA and negotiations. In the case of Serbia, well, suddenly I think you'll find that various chapters will be closed. Closed as in not open, rather than closed. Sorry, remembering the technical difference that exists when talking with the EU. I think the Denise's point, very, very good question on that. Mixed picture. I had the misfortune to go to Bosnia 10 days ago. And, you know, the difference to see the impact of the European Union and what it's managed to achieve between Belgrade and Pristina, between Serbia and Kosovo, it's been incredible. And it's absolutely, without a shadow of a doubt, it's amazing to see what the EU's managed to do in a situation. You know, 5 years ago, we would never have believed we are where we are. However, go to Bosnia and, my God, a depressing situation. The politicians there seem completely immune to the influence of the European Union. It means nothing to them whatsoever in terms of trying to get them to shift their positions. And if you like, this is the big question I have in my mind. And I, you know, I've been thinking about it non-stop since I got back. You know, why is it that the EU has managed to do what it did between Serbia and Kosovo and yet has seemed completely unable to shift the prevailing views on the ground in Bosnia? So a mixed picture, and I think, you know, this is a key question we're having to ask ourselves.
It opens a whole new topic.
Yes, absolutely. Sorry, didn't we?
Awesome. Would you like to have the final word?
I would like to say as a final word that I am much more cautious when I use the notion of the transformative power of the European Union. I'm not a Eurosceptic, on the opposite, but I'm also very, very cautious in how the EU is changing countries in terms of how they behave as members and in terms of their own systems. But what I do believe is that the EU has influence. And I do believe that when Germany goes to Serbia, Serbia listens to Germany. And I also think that politicians are practical in that part of the world, and they do see the limits of what Russia and Turkey can offer. They may use it in terms of you know, rhetoric, but they also know that if there is a chance for them to have some kind of an anchor, that is with the European Union. Practical matters.
Thank you very much indeed. I mean, I think we've had a fascinating morning. One of the interesting things for me was to see how important in this sort of process facilitation is. Rather than always relying on intervention, whether it's diplomatic intervention or what they call hard power. But I think facilitation is a role which the EU has played very well here. And certainly listening to what we've heard this morning, I think they are to be congratulated. Can I ask you to thank our panel for coming this morning and giving us such a clear explanation?